From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, making an elementary school work in the poorest and most dangerous part of Philadelphia. We talk with Madeline Cartwright about her decade as a principal. Also today, the authors of two children's books that have been the focus of controversy in schools and libraries. We talk with Leslea Newman, author of Heather S. Two Mommies, and Michael Wilhoit, author of Daddy's Roommate. Both books tell the stories of children of gay parents. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new cyberpunk novel by William Gibson, Virtual Light. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton and Vice President Al Gore outlined their proposal to reinvent government this morning. The plan is designed to shrink the size of government and make it more efficient. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Standing in front of two forklift trucks piled high with thousands of pages of government rules and regulations, the president and vice president promised a sweeping reform of the way government operates. The purpose, they said, was to make the federal bureaucracy smaller, cheaper, and more efficient, and in the process, increase the confidence and trust of the American people in their government. Included in the recommendations is a proposal to cut 250,000 jobs, or 12% of the federal workforce, over the next 5 years. Some of that downsizing would occur by reducing the Agriculture Department's 12,000 field offices by 10%, combining the law enforcement functions of the Drug Enforcement Administration and the FBI. If all the recommendations are enacted, the White House estimates that $108 billion will be saved over 5 years. About half the recommendations can be accomplished by executive order. The rest will have to be approved by Congress. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
South African negotiators have come up with a bill creating a multi-party panel to prepare the way for the country's multiracial elections next April. Supporters said the measure will give members of the country's black majority their first taste of real political power. It would also clear away one of the last obstacles to lifting international economic sanctions imposed on South Africa as punishment for apartheid. Thousands of Israelis have been pouring into Jerusalem to show their opposition to the plan to give limited autonomy to the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Alex Brody reports from Jerusalem.
It is a big rally, and extraordinary security measures are in place to contain it. Double lines of metal police barricades and at least 2,000 police ringing the government area of Jerusalem with, at its heart, the Prime Minister's office. Periodically, searchlights from a circling helicopter sweep the crowd. The organizers say that on the basis of buses they've laid on, they expect 150,000 people. Columns of people are still arriving, and it's early. They plan to keep this going all night, to lay siege to the Prime Minister's office, and to stop the business of government tomorrow. The aim, say the organizers, is to prove that the government has no mandate for its deal with the PLO. Some extremist settlers have threatened to provoke violence tonight. The government has said it will do everything to ensure people can exercise their right to protest, but will not tolerate an assault on democracy.
Alex Brody for the BBC. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 27 points to close at 3,607. The NASDAQ Composite Index was down 10.36 at 739.35. This is NPR News from Washington. Some U.S. intelligence experts are still claiming that a Chinese ship was carrying materials for making chemical weapons to Iran, even though a recent search found nothing. The Reuters news agency quoted a U.S. official who said experts believe the materials were taken off the ship sometime after it left China. The ship was held up for 24 days while the United States demanded a full inspection of its cargo. China has demanded compensation and an apology after an inspection team found no trace of the chemicals. A survey of American households has determined that at least 1 million people have illegally used muscle-building anabolic steroids. The survey also found a strong link between steroid use and other illicit drugs. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this report.
The steroid study was part of the National Household Survey on Drug Abuse, and was the first to ask families about anabolic steroids. These drugs have been popular among professional and Olympic athletes to boost performance, but are suspected of causing serious side effects. The survey found that steroids are growing more popular among recreational athletes as well. In 1991, more than 300,000 people had used steroids over the previous year. Men were far more likely to use them than women, and the average user started taking steroids at age 18. Writing in this week's issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association, researchers said steroid users, especially those aged 12 to 17, were more likely to say that they committed aggressive acts or property crimes when compared to their peers. This is Christopher Joyce reporting.
In Sonora, California, a jury is hearing arguments over the sanity of a woman who shot and killed a man accused of molesting her son. The same jury has already convicted Ellen Nessler of manslaughter. Nessler's lawyer says she was mentally incompetent at the moment she committed the crime. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This week, many children in inner cities are heading back to schools that are run down, unsafe, and underfunded. With many urban public schools doomed to fail, it often helps to hear the stories of educators who have made their schools work. My guest Madeline Cartwright tells one such story in her new book, For the Children. Cartwright spent 11 years as the principal of the Blaine Elementary School in the heart of North Philadelphia, which she describes as the poorest and most dangerous part of the city. Under her leadership, the school started winning attendance awards for both students and teachers. Hundreds of parents showed up for the meetings she organized. Philadelphia newspaper articles and editorials praised her leadership. Cartwright briefly took over a junior high school after Blaine and then headed up a program to involve parents in the city's schools. This year, she isn't heading back to school. She's retired. I asked her to remember back to 1979 when she became the principal at Blaine and to describe the physical state of the school then.
Okay, when I came into Blaine, the school was not clean. There were roaches walking as if they were on roll, and mice the same way. The walls were cinder block. There was dirt in the little cracks in the cinder block. The floors, an inch, two from the floor, from the walls, was just black, black, black. It was just a dirty, dirty place. And it was all right. It was all right with everybody.
Everybody was just reconciled.
The teacher's lounge had a sink with no faucet. The faucet didn't work. The stove in the teacher's lounge was just downright filthy. But it was all right.
Your desk, the principal's desk, had roaches in it.
Yeah, that's a funny thing. There were roaches inside the desk drawers. And also in the telephone. I banged the telephone down one day, and roaches jumped out of the telephone. And I got right up quickly. That's another thing, too, is I have no tolerance for bugs. None. So that right there made me know something had to happen.
What did you see as your role as principal in getting the school physically cleaned up?
I knew I could. I knew that as principal, I had the authority to clean it. And along with the authority was the responsibility to clean it up. So I began then saying that children have no business in a place that's this dirty. And we have to clean it.
Tell a story about how you cleaned the bathroom.
Okay, I went into the boys' room, and I had spoken to the custodian about it, and he had cleaned it, quote around cleaned. When I came back into it, I could still smell the odor. The stench was just so strong. So I said to him, "This bathroom needs to be cleaned." He said, "I just cleaned it." I said, "You couldn't have cleaned it. It's still nasty." So he said, the urine is in the cement. It won't come out." I said, "Now, mister, it is not in the cement. It will come out." So I said, "You go give me a bucket of water and a brush, and I'll show you what come out." He went to get the bucket of water and the brush. I took off my stockings and my shoes so I could reuse water freely and not worry about ruining my shoes. He came back with the bucket, and I took the brush, and I scrubbed the walls around the toilet. I scrubbed all around the toilet and the floors and kept dumping plenty of water. When I finished, there was no odor in that bathroom at all. I turned to him and said, "Do you smell anything?" He looked at me and said, "No, ma'am." And he knew right then I wanted the bathrooms cleaned. And from then on, he cleaned the bathrooms.
Now, what did you think the wisdom was of you, the new principal, taking off her shoes and stockings and getting on her hands and knees to scrub the boys' room?
It had to say to the folks that I wanted it to be right. And whatever I had to do to bring about the change I wanted, I was willing to do that. And I'd be expecting everybody else to do whatever they had to do to bring about the change we wanted.
Now, that included spending 1 month of the summer with as many parents as you could recruit, cleaning the rest of the school.
That's right. I came to the school in March. So in June, when we had the little graduation ceremony for the little kids who were leaving in the sixth grade, all the parents came. Now, that's one place you can look for parents, is for this little graduation, we called it. All the parents were there. And I talked to them about having visited the McDonald's restaurant and how clean it was. And I said, kids don't have to come there. But here they have to come, and there's no reason that this school can't be as clean as any restaurant or any hospital that you enter, and we have to clean it. And I said, can I get somebody to help me? I said, because I know how many people still have kids in the school. They raise their hands. I said, I know those folks with their hands. Keep your hands up. The folks with your hands up. I know you don't want your kids in a dirty school, do you? No, we don't. Will you help me clean it? Keep your hands up. Will you help me clean it? Then I had somebody run around and take their names. And that's all we did. That's all we did. And then we told them that on July 1st, we were going to commence cleaning that school. Without calling another parent or anything, on July 1st, when I showed up at that school, there were 17 parents standing there with pails in their hands waiting to clean that building.
Now, what do you think the final value was of cleaning up the bathrooms and then having parents come in to clean up the rest of the school? Did it change the students or the parents?
Oh, sure, it did.
Or the teachers' attitudes about school?
Yeah, I think there was an adjustment there for everybody. I think that when the teachers came back in September, the building was clean, and I mean clean. We had taken paint scrapers and egg turners and scraped wax up off of that floor that had been there for 10 years. We cleaned it spotless. We washed the windows in the office. We put Venetian blinds on the windows. We painted the office furniture bright green, and we had little toys hanging from the ceiling. It just was a beautiful, it rivaled McDonald's. The teachers came in, they looked to see that this is going to be different. But still, that was the office. Many schools had clean offices. But as the teachers left their rooms and walked down the hallways to see the hallway was spotless clean, when they got in their own classrooms, they saw that the classrooms they left were not the classrooms they reentered. In Philadelphia, you don't get a new shade on the window unless the shade tears up and won't go up and down. But here they had, we took all the shades down. The shades are very good material. They'll wash. They're washed like oilcloth. We took them down, put them on the floor, scrubbed them, hosed them, put them back. So they walked into sparkling, clean rooms. They knew that here is a person who said the children have to be respected by coming into a clean place. And they knew that if we had worked that hard all summer, that we meant for children to be respected.
Now, did you get paid for that month that you worked?
Oh, no, 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 no. No. Well, we got paid in no money. But we got paid in learning to know the parents, and they got to know me, and they spread it out through the neighborhood that she's just like we are. We can trust her. We can trust her. She's the same as we are. That, I think, is a problem with schools. We don't trust. Back and forth. We don't trust the parents. Parents don't trust us. We're afraid to touch kids, afraid the parents are going to sue us. Parents don't know if we're going to turn them into the welfare, call the police, using them for one thing or another. I mean, what's your real motive here? Can't be to help me. You must be using me for something. So it's trust that we built.
What role did you want your school to play in the lives of the children and their families?
I wanted the school to educate the children, but I also wanted the school to serve the children and their families. You know, I had families in the Blaine area who did not know how to turn a telephone on, who did not know how to return a purchase for something that had broken or torn, that buy a jacket, the zipper breaks, throw it in the corner, and save money for another one. And I wanted to show them that they could live, fix the jacket, take it back. I wanted to show them all the things that my mother knew, for whatever reason she knew. I think our mother might have told her. But she knew how to repair and how to make do. We had 12 children during the Depression, and we made do. And I wanted to show them that as hard as it was, they could make do and they could be proud. And that I thought the school could help do.
Now, one of the things you did, and this is a kind of almost legendary story now.
The
washing machine, right. You brought in a washing machine, a dryer, and a sewing machine into the school. Why did you do that?
That was the same reason. To show parents that you could wash clothes and keep them. You could sew something that tore and keep it, not replace it. And then also, too, is to have youngsters walk into that building in the morning and look good. If a youngster came in whose clothing was not clean, we took him into the dressing room, took off his clothes, her clothes, washed them up good, gave them our clothes to put on, fixed their little hair. And while they were gone, we sewed their clothes if they were torn, put them in the washing machine, washed them, gave them back to them at the end of the day. So the youngsters knew they could feel good in school all day. And my kids looked good every day, all day. If their hair wasn't fixed, we fixed it. Whatever a youngster needed to walk up those stairs feeling good about himself, we provided that for him.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Madeline Cartwright, and her new book, For the Children, is in part about her decade as principal of an elementary school in Philadelphia's inner city. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Madeline Cartwright. She was a teacher in the Philadelphia school system for about 17 years. For about a decade, she was the principal of an elementary school in Philadelphia's inner city. And now she heads a parent involvement program for the city of Philadelphia. She's written a new book called For the Children. Now, the neighborhood that your school was in was a pretty dangerous neighborhood, a lot of crime in the neighborhood. What did you do to keep the school safe? Safe, you know, protected from outside danger and also protected from bullies within the school.
Okay, then the outside part of the school, I talked to the children. I never walked anywhere through that neighborhood and passed a soul that I didn't say good morning to and insist that they say good morning back. If I passed anybody and I said good morning, they didn't answer, I'd say, excuse me, do you see me? Did I speak to you? Sometimes I'd let them pass me without speaking. And once they passed me, I'd say, do I look like a tree or a car? Come back and say, good morning, I'm a person. We speak to each other. So that I knew the entire neighborhood, and I walked the neighborhood often, so that I got to know everybody who lived in the perimeter of that school. So everybody knew us. So it wasn't a thing where we were afraid of the folks, and they weren't afraid of us. I mean, they kind of respected. I'll tell you another thing, too. As I said to them, don't steal anything from this building. If you steal it, you've got it one time. If you don't steal it, it's here for you to use. Whatever you need, if I have it, you can use it. If you're going to have a party, you need a record player, come over, borrow it, use it, bring it back. It's here for somebody else and here for you. If you need a table, no problem. Come over, take your legs off the table, take it to your place. My custodian will go, put the legs back on, go take them off and bring them back. So that everybody began to feel like the school really was theirs. And we didn't have a problem with outside. With the inside, I insisted that there be no fighting. You must not fight. You must not fight. And invariably when they fought, I'd say, well, don't you know that we have a rule not to fight? Why didn't you tell your teacher? Well, she wasn't going to do anything about it. And I said, well, how do you know what she would do? Well, she didn't do anything before. And I said, well, what did you do before? When she didn't do anything, what did you do? You should have come to me. I said, you have to go to the immediate person who's there. If they don't do anything, then you go to the next person. And eventually you come to me. I will do something. You absolutely must not fight. And we held forth to that. And if there were a fight, I was right there on it. And I made sure that teachers responded to the needs of the children.
You know, I think a typical way of dealing with somebody who is a real bully in the school is that they step far out of line. You suspend them. You kick them out for a few weeks. You ban suspensions in the school.
Well, I felt that suspension, as I viewed it, should have been time for a child to go home, talk with his parents about the problem, some kind of a free time for the parent to be with the child away from the other children to discuss the problems and to see how they could remedy it. I didn't see that happening in the years that I taught in Philadelphia. I taught 17 years before becoming principal. I would see a youngster suspended, and the next day he's riding a bicycle all around through the kids while they're playing recess. So the suspension wasn't doing what I thought it should do. Also, I saw many homes not capable of giving the kind of lessons that we wanted for suspension. So rather than take a chance for a youngster, maybe his mother was working, for a youngster to be home by himself being suspended, or taking a chance of a youngster going home and not serving what I wanted to serve, I didn't suspend them. I said, you have a right to education. You have to come to school. I come. That the only time you'll be suspended from Blaine is if you are a clear and present danger to yourself while in the building, other children, teacher, or us. Then I'll suspend you. And so, I weighed 200 pounds.
So what did you think appropriate punishment was for a bully or for someone who just acts up constantly and disrupts the class?
Most often, if I brought a youngster down to the office and I said we had a pledge, we said, that I will act in such a way that I will be proud of myself and others will be proud of me, too. I came to school to learn, and I will learn. I will have a good day. Some of the youngsters came. I'd say, well, did you say your pledge this morning? Let me hear you say it. He'd say it. And I said, well, you think I'm proud of this? Are you proud of yourself? Well, no. Do you think I'm proud? Your mother would be proud? Oh, no. Well, as soon as the youngster broke down, then you knew right then punishment was enough right there. He had realized that he had done something wrong, that he was ready to make amends. The youngsters got so they just wanted me to love them. They wanted our approval. And they stayed in line. When they came out of line, there were punishments that we had. We didn't allow them to go to recess. We may have kept them after school. We may not have. I did not allow the keeping from a trip. Every youngster had to go on every trip. A trip to me was an educational experience, and you can't punish you. The same as sending you home. If I'm sending you home, I'm stopping you from being educated. It's not the way to do it. And then sometimes, if a youngster just was too far out of hand, I couldn't bring him back in hand, I would say to him, what does your mother do? And he would say, well, my mother will spank me. And I would say, let me call your mother, and I'll call her, and maybe she'll spank you, and that'll help. Well, no, please don't do that. And I would say, why? And then I would listen to them. Sometimes I would spank them. And I would spank them because I would have them bend over the chair, and I'd hit them three times, two times, never more than three. And that would maybe turn them around. If they left out of the classroom, they would say, well, I'll see you later, Miss Cartwright. You see, it wasn't such a thing that it was like I was angry with them and didn't like them. It was that this was a punishment that went along with this infraction. And basically that was for hitting other children. Because the kids seemed like if someone hit them, they weren't happy unless someone hit him back. They felt that they had to do something. A hit had to be for a hit.
Now, you weren't worried about a lawsuit of a parent going to the superintendent of school saying, the principal of this school hit my child.
Yeah.
Because parents often think that their children are incapable of doing wrong, right?
Yeah, and that was a chance that I had to take. And I took that chance. It never happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I took that chance because the children felt that if someone hit them and no one hit him back, that he was just not satisfied. And I said to them that I will satisfy you. It's not necessary for you to take law in your own hands. And I went on and tried that, and I got through it. Yeah.
Now, you say something very interesting in your book about controlling students. You say you can't control inner city kids through intimidating them. You
right.
can't control them through fear.
Mm-hmm. See, you know, and the same thing, too, is you talk about controlling children. And what you have to do is support youngsters in the understanding that this is unacceptable behavior.
Well,
this behavior is unacceptable.
Why won't fear work, first of all? Why won't fear work as a disciplinary tool?
Well, listen, fear is not going to work because what are you going to do to a child that will frighten him when he has walked through 10 stories of a project building where I'm afraid to go into projects, you are afraid to go into projects, but he has walked through it? What kind of fear can you put in him that will start to match that? Or somebody beating him up? And many of our youngsters have seen violence like you can't even imagine. So that is not the way to do it. It has to be a different way. You had to do it through support and love and understanding and counseling.
Now, there were outside problems that your kids had that you often took on yourself as principal. For instance, one morning there was a student who showed up in front of the school with a scalded arm, not knowing what to do.
Yeah, that's a sad situation. Here was a youngster who was about 7, 8 years old, whose mother was retarded to any given eye. You could just look at her and talk with her 2 minutes, and you knew that she needed help. And this youngster had been cooking the night before with the mother and burned his arm. Hot grease had scalded his arm. He came to school. When I got there at 7:30 because my daughter took a bus from our school to her school. So I got there at 7:30. He was there at 7:30 with this arm, and it was scalded away. I mean, you could just see it was burned away. So he wasn't crying. He was just sitting there waiting for me to come. So when I got there, I called the school community coordinator. I said, look at this boy's arm. Go get his mother. Because you have to have his mother in order to take him to the hospital. So she went and got his mother, took him and his mother to the hospital, and had his arm attended to. But I looked at that and I saw that boy was able to get through the night and to be sitting there because he knew that come morning, I was going to be there and get help for him. And you think of the youngster who is in a situation like that, who has no light at the end of the tunnel.
Some of the advice you gave the teachers was, you said, never say to one of the students, doing your homework tonight is your priority.
Yeah.
What's wrong with saying that?
Okay. You might could say that to a child. And we said it to them. I said it to them. But you had to know that when that child came back the next morning and his homework wasn't done, you had to look into why his homework wasn't done. You couldn't stand in front of the classroom with a blanket. Anybody doesn't have his homework, I'm going to do this, that, and that, and the other. Or you're not interested in school. You had to look at if this youngster doesn't have his homework, and we have told him that homework must be a priority. Because in a child's life, homework should be the first priority. But many of our children were not living the lives of children. They were taking care of little kids, taking care of their mother, taking care of the house, taking care of themselves, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. So that in their lives, homework wasn't first.
Now, how does a teacher with 30 kids in the class try to assess whether somebody didn't do their homework because they're just being lazy and therefore she needs to try to either, you know, discipline them a little bit or be more encouraging for them to do their homework? The difference between that and someone who didn't do their homework because
it's a whole picture.
All hell was breaking loose at home that night.
It's a whole picture. You know, you begin to look at a youngster and you see that this youngster is not a child. He is not happy and playing and reaching on the table, tickling somebody. It becomes a picture. You can see who the children are who are living children's lives. And you can see who the children are who have the responsibility of adults.
As a principal, part of what you did in the elementary school was you brought in a washing machine, a dryer, a sewing machine. You took care of kids. You kept them clean. You washed their clothes. And when I say you, I mean you and your staff and your teachers and so on. Is this the kind of things schools need to do now in order to succeed? I mean, is this what you're recommending, that all principals should bring in washing machines and dryers? Is that what we need now?
I'm saying that the school needs to bring into the school what is needed. In that building, we needed a washer and a dryer. I think there has to be a coming together of the social agencies, the welfare department, the health department. They need to come together in the school. I don't mean visit the school. I think they need to move into the school. If a welfare worker has 100 cases and there are 100 cases in the school, and that's what they have in Philadelphia, the health welfare workers have 100 cases. I called and asked them. I found that they have 100 cases. I found I had 600 kids. I said, I'm due 3, 4 welfare workers. Rather than giving me a welfare worker who has a kid in this school, that school, and that school, and that school, give me a welfare worker and let her get all of her cases out of my school. And let me have them right here so they can learn to know the children as I know them, learn to know the parents as I know them. Have the health agency right here. If we hire a dentist, does that dentist carry more than 650 kids? If he doesn't, then give me my dentist. Give me mine right here in the school. If the doctor takes care of in the health department, if he takes care of 600 children, if I have 600, give me my doctor. Bring it all right here so everybody can begin to intermingle with each other, interact with each other, and serve the children and their families.
So you're saying, yes, the schools need to become part of the social...
Part of the whole
social welfare system.
It all has to come together because it's the whole child we're talking about. We're talking about teaching the whole child. We're talking about holistic teaching. We're talking about holistic living and bring the child together so he can live.
Madeline Cartwright, I thank you very, very much for sharing some of your experiences with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Madeline Cartwright is the author of For the Children. She just retired from the Philadelphia school system. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Heather Has Two Mommies and Daddy's Roommate are two children's books about growing up with gay parents. These books are at the center of ongoing debates over whether there's a place in the classroom or in the children's section of the library for such subject matter. Coming up, we'll talk with the authors of the books, Leslie Newman and Michael Wilhoit. And book critic John Leonard reviews William Gibson's latest cyberpunk thriller, Virtual Light. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Dr. Joyce Lynn Elders has been confirmed by the Senate as U.S. Surgeon General. The vote was 65 to 34. Senators debated her nomination for more than 6 hours today. Conservatives who opposed her nomination acknowledged in advance the former Arkansas health chief would win confirmation. Conservatives had vigorously argued that Elders' views, in support of abortion rights, for example, were out of the mainstream. Today in West Palm Beach, Florida, two white men were convicted of kidnapping, robbing, and setting on fire a black tourist last New Year's Day. The jury took 12 hours to decide the case, one that hinged mostly on eyewitness accounts from the victim himself. From member station WUSF, Bobby O'Brien reports.
Defendants Charles Rourke and Mark Cohut showed no emotion during the clerk's reading of the verdicts, guilty of robbing, kidnapping, and the attempted murder of Chris Wilson, the black Brooklyn man who was taunted with racial slurs as he was doused with gasoline and then set on fire. Wilson's mother, in a written statement, said, "As a black mother, I would like to say never would I wish for anyone, whether black or white, to have to undergo the pain, agony, and frustrations we've been through and are still going through." For National Public Radio, I'm Bobby O'Brien in West Palm Beach.
The white-minority South African government has agreed to a power-sharing plan with its political rivals. The agreement is a major step toward ending 300 years of white political domination. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
Under the agreement, some two dozen political groups will be represented on a new transitional executive council with authority to oversee and, in many cases, overrule actions by the white minority government. The new council's most sweeping powers include broad authority to investigate police and other security forces. It will also create a new national peacekeeping force whose members will be drawn from government security ranks as well as from the underground armies of black political groups that once fought the apartheid regime. The council still requires formal approval from South Africa's segregated parliament, but that is expected next week, and the council could be in operation sometime next month. I'm Ann Cooper reporting.
Nearly half of some 400 Palestinian deportees will leave their makeshift camp in Lebanon and return to Israel this week. The men were deported last December to Lebanon for alleged links to hostile Muslim groups. Most of the deportees are members or supporters of Hamas, an Islamic resistance group, but some of the men were found to be falsely accused. The leader of the deportees says the group had intended to stay in the no man's land, but decided to return because many men had fallen ill. Stocks lost ground today on Wall Street. The Dow lost nearly 27 points to end the day at 3,607. This is NPR. President Bill Clinton and Vice President Al Gore have released their sweeping plan to streamline the government. The plan was written over the last 6 months by a panel headed by Gore. The so-called Reinventing Government proposal seeks to cut the federal bureaucracy and save more than $100 billion of waste over 5 years. Gore says the proposal will gradually reduce the federal bureaucracy by 12% and cut wasteful spending and burdensome regulations. In Los Angeles, a third witness has identified one of the defendants in the Reginald Denny beating trial. Two black men, men are charged with a dozen counts of beating a white truck driver during the L.A. riots. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports.
Police Officer Timothy McGrath testified today that he knew defendant Damian Williams from more than 10 prior contacts and that he had seen him earlier while on patrol at the intersection where trucker Denny was later beaten. Williams was in the crowd and taunted him, the police officer testified, with the words, "If you were any kind of a nigger, you'd be out here with the rest of us." Officer McGrath then went home where he watched news accounts of the violence and recognized Williams, he said, throwing a brick at the truck driver's head. There was no doubt, the policeman testified, it was Damian Williams. Earlier, defense lawyers tried to discredit a TV cameraman who had positively identified both defendants, pointing out that he wasn't wearing his glasses while watching the attack through binoculars, but the cameraman stuck to his story, saying the binoculars were as good as glasses. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
A Virginia state judge has awarded custody of a lesbian woman's 2-year-old son to the boy's grandmother, saying the mother's relationship with her partner makes her an unfit parent. The case is unusual because it pits a non-parent against a mother whose only alleged parental shortcoming is her homosexuality. Attorneys say the case will be appealed. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Heather Has Two Mommies and Daddy's Roommate are two of the most controversial children's books of our time. Why? Because they're about children with gay parents. In New York City's multicultural rainbow curriculum, they were included in the bibliography of optional reading material. But protest against them was so forceful, the books were removed from the list. Similar controversies have erupted around these books in other schools and in libraries, where some parents' groups have demanded that the books be removed from the shelves. What exactly do these books have to say? In a moment, you'll hear for yourself. My guests are Leslia Newman, author of Heather Has Two Mommies, and Michael Wilhoit, author of Daddy's Roommate. I asked them if they wrote the books with the idea that they would be used in schools.
No, I had no idea the book would be used in school. The reason I wrote Heather was that I was walking down the street and a lesbian came up to me and asked me if I would write a book that reflected her family. So it wasn't an idea that I had.
So you kind of picture this as mothers reading the book to their children to kind of give them the chance to see their own lives reflected in a book.
Exactly.
And Michael, what about you?
Well, I simply wrote something to illustrate because that's what I am first and foremost as an artist. Sasha Allison, my publisher, wanted me to do a children's book because he was starting this line with a gay slant. So the first thing I thought of was the title, and it took me a while to come up with the book, but I finally did it. And what I really intended to do was to simply do a book for the children who found themselves in the situation of having a gay parent.
Well, instead of talking about your books in the abstract, I'm going to ask each of you to read an excerpt of the book, and then we'll talk more about the controversy surrounding the books. Leslia, let's start with you. Maybe you could read the first part of Heather Has Two Mommies for us.
This is Heather. She lives in a little house with a big apple tree in the front yard and lots of tall grass in the backyard. Heather's favorite number is 2. She has 2 arms, 2 legs, 2 eyes, 2 ears, 2 hands, and 2 feet. Heather has 2 pets, a ginger-colored cat named Ginger Snap and a big black dog named Midnight. Heather also has 2 mommies, Mama Jane and Mama Kate. A long, long time ago, before Heather was born, Mama Jane and Mama Kate were very good friends. Only they weren't mommies then. They were just Jane and Kate. Kate lived on one side of town with Midnight, and Jane lived on the other side of town with Ginger Snap. After they were friends for a long, long time, Kate and Jane realized that they were very much in love with each other. They decided they wanted to live together and be a family together. So Jane and Kate and Midnight and Gingersnap all moved into the little house with the big apple tree in the front yard and the tall grass in the backyard, and they were all very happy except for one thing. Kate and Jane wanted to have a baby. After they talked about it for a long time, they decided the baby would grow in Jane's womb. A womb is a special place inside a woman where babies grow. Jane ate lots of good food and got plenty of rest so she would be strong and healthy to carry the baby. Kate and Jane went to see a special doctor together. After the doctor examined Jane to make sure that she was healthy, she put some sperm into Jane's vagina. The sperm swam up into Jane's womb. If there was an egg waiting there, the sperm and the egg would meet and the baby would start to grow. Jane and Kate waited and waited to see if the sperm and the egg had started to grow into a baby. About a month went by. Then Jane said she felt a little funny. She was hungry a lot, and her breasts felt tender. After another month went by, Jane's belly started getting bigger. There was a baby growing inside of Jane's womb. Kate and Jane were so happy, they hugged each other and kissed each other and laughed so hard that they cried. This is what Jane looked like right before Heather was born. Her belly grew so big she had to get all new clothes. Kate put her hand on Jane's belly to feel the baby kick. "She's strong," Kate said. Soon it was time for Heather to be born. Jane sat up in bed and pushed and pushed. A special nurse called the midwife was there to help. Kate was there to help, too. When the baby's head was showing, the midwife stepped back and out popped baby Heather right into Kate's arms.
And that's an excerpt of Heather Has Two Mommies. Leslie, I think the most controversial part of this book is the part about artificial insemination. Now, the book is promoted as being for children of ages 3 to 8. Do you really think that 3- and 4-year-olds are capable of comprehending what artificial insemination is?
Well, I'll talk about that page because originally that page wasn't in the book. And originally the book was self-published. And the one New York publisher that was interested in the book said to me, there has to be something in here about how the mother got pregnant because kids know that two women can't make a baby. So what I did was I went around to different lesbian parents and said, what do you tell your children? What would you like to see in a book? And that's what I came up with. And I also use the term alternative insemination rather than artificial insemination. And the page is really, you can use the page in a lot of ways. You could use it to discuss with your children where they came from, how they were conceived. Or a lot of mothers I know skip that page until they think their child is ready to talk about it.
Don't the children ask, what's on that page, Mommy?
Well, I was a daycare teacher for many years, and, you know, half the time I made up the words to books.
Mm-hmm. Well, if an editor asked you to put it in and then ended up not publishing the book anyways, did you ever think of taking it out? Did you want it in? Did you think that it worked for kids who are 3 and 4?
I didn't think it was necessary, but I don't regret it. I don't think it's a bad thing.
What other parts of the book have been most controversial for you?
Just the whole concept that this child has two mommies and she's a happy, well-adjusted child and she lives her life like any other kid. People seem to have a very hard time with that. You know, people say that the book is too sugary and that Heather should have some problems.
What do you think about that?
Well, at the time that I wrote and published the book, there was no other book for kids with lesbian parents, and I thought if all these children are going to have one book, I'd rather it be a happy book.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, these kids don't need the Well of Loneliness.
But it's interesting. You I don't know if this is published yet, but I know you were working on a book about a lesbian couple who gets a divorce and what it's
right.
like for their child. Is that book finished yet?
Yeah, that book is out. It's called Saturday is Patty Day. It was published by New Victoria Publishers just this year. And that's another book that reflects some kids' reality.
And what's the story you tell in that book?
The book is about a little boy named Frankie who lives with his two mothers, Patty and Allie, and Patty and Allie split up, so every Saturday Frankie goes to see Patty. So, and the book takes place, his first visit to Patty after his mommy split up.
Okay. Michael Wilhoit, I'd like you to read from your book, Daddy's Roommate. And
All right.
I've picked out a couple of excerpts for you to read from this.
My mommy and daddy got a divorce last year. Now, there's somebody new at daddy's house. Daddy and his roommate Frank live together, work together, eat together, sleep together, shave together, and sometimes even fight together. But they always make up. Frank likes me, too. Just like Daddy, he tells me jokes and riddles. Mommy says Daddy and Frank are gay. At first, I didn't know what that meant, so she explained it. Being gay is just one more kind of love, and love is the best kind of happiness. Daddy and his roommate are very happy together, and I'm happy, too.
No, I'm sure this is the last question in the book here is, you know, what does it mean to be gay? I'm sure this is a question that kids ask a lot. How did you go about deciding how to address that in the book?
Well, I honestly didn't know what to do at first. I thought if I went into the logistics of what it was like for two men to go to bed together, I thought it would be altogether unsuitable for a children's book. So I decided to focus on the love aspect, which is, after all, something that's I think much more important than sex, and which tends to get overlooked by people who find objection to the gay lifestyle.
My guests are Michael Wilhoit, author of Daddy's Roommate, and Leslea Newman, author of Heather Has Two Mommies. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Leslea Newman and Michael Wilhoit. Their books about children of gay parents have been at the center of controversies in schools and libraries. Now, both of these books, Heather Has Two Mommies and Daddy's Roommate, were at first included in what was called the Rainbow Curriculum in New York City. This is a multicultural curriculum. It was included only in the bibliography. It wasn't part of the literature that was supposed to be taught in the classroom, but it was in the bibliography of other reading or recommended reading. And because of the controversy around those two books, the two books were later removed from the bibliography. How involved did you get in that controversy?
Well, I went down to New York quite often since I'm a native New Yorker, and I was very interested in what was going on down there. So I spoke to a lot of groups and was really horrified, actually, to see how much hatred was directed at gay families, gay school board members. It was horrendous. It was very frightening.
Michael, what about you?
Well,
did you get involved with it?
No, I didn't. I didn't get involved with it at all. I have a full-time job aside from my illustration and writing, which is a sideline, and I just don't have the opportunity to go to New York as often as I'd like. Or I might very well have done so.
How would you see, Leslea, your book being used in the classroom? What context would you imagine?
Well, context, talking about different kinds of families.
Mm-hmm.
I was a daycare teacher for a long time, and one thing that kids do is talk about their families constantly, what they did over the weekend with mommy or mommy and daddy or daddy and daddy or, you know, whatever your constellation is. And it's really important for every child to feel safe talking about whatever kind of family she or he comes from. So I thought it would be a way to put kids at ease with all types of families.
How have your books done in libraries?
Oh, that is some topic. I'm not sure about Heather Has Two Mommies, although our books have been sort of attacked and praised together. But the libraries have really borne the brunt of the controversy. But somewhere between 30 and 40 libraries have been attacked, or at least petitioned to have the books removed from their shelves. And very much to the librarian's credit, only about three have done anything about it. And all they've done really is simply to move it to the adult shelves.
Michael, I'm going to put you on the spot a second and ask you what you think of the artificial insemination page in Heather Has Two Mommies.
Me? Well, okay, I think it's a good idea. Frankly, I wonder about its being appropriate for younger children. But again, I think if a mother has the option of skipping the page, why not go ahead and do it?
For both of you, this was your first children's book, but you each went on to write other children's books.
That's right.
Do you feel that your
notoriety?
No, that's what I was thinking of. That your comfort with the genre has increased. Do you feel like you've learned a lot by writing more books about what works with children?
Oh, I know I have.
I definitely have. I've gone on to write, I think, 7 children's books, and I won a children's writing award last year, and then I've also gotten contracts with a major publisher for 2 books. So I hope that symbolizes that I have improved a little bit and I know a little more about what I'm doing.
Are all those books about children in lesbian families?
No, one of my books that Clarion is bringing out is called Remember That, and it's about a young Jewish girl and her relationship with her grandmother who goes into a nursing home. And the other book is called Too Far Away to Touch, Close Enough to See, and it's about a little girl whose favorite uncle is gay and living with AIDS.
Mm-hmm. And what about you, Michael? Have all your children's books been on gay themes?
Yes, essentially. My second book was done in collaboration with Leslea. She wrote a wonderful story called Belinda's Bouquet, and I did the illustrations for it. And the lesbian angle to this book is very slight. It's about this little girl named Belinda and her friend Daniel. And Daniel has two mothers. And nothing much is made... I'm sorry. Nothing much more than that is made of it.
Yeah, this is a book about her being self-conscious.
It's about self-esteem.
Yeah, because she's been called fat.
Yes, a very insensitive adult.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What do you say to parents who think that... why should their children have to be exposed to this? In their community, there aren't openly gay couples. There aren't openly gay couples in their neighborhood. It isn't an issue in their immediate community. So why should they have to learn about this in school, and then the kids will come home and ask questions of the parents that the parents are very uncomfortable discussing?
Well, first I would say to the parents, look again, because every person in the country knows someone who's gay or lesbian, whether they want to admit it or not. And then I might tell them the thing that so many parents don't want to hear, which is that they have a 1 in 10% chance of raising someone who's going to grow up to be gay or lesbian, and not to make incredible assumptions that everyone they know is heterosexual. And, you know, it's the 90s. If they really want to prepare their children to live in this world, they've got to be open to all kinds of people and all kinds of families.
Why do you think your books have become such flashpoints in the debate about homosexuality?
Because when you put kids and a subject like this together, people get very protective of their children.
And people have such a huge fear that their children are going to grow up to be gay or lesbian. I mean, as if that would be such a bad thing. I mean, I think people could handle, you know, that their kids are going to be axe murderers more easily sometimes because they think this is such an abomination.
And you're saying that people assume that your book is almost like an instruction manual or something that would, like, give permission to children to grow up and be gay or something?
Yes, I get that impression.
I really don't understand it because, you know, when I read this book to kids, the kids relate to Heather. The kids aren't relating to her mommies as role models. They're just looking at Heather. So, you know, I think that the adults that are so against these books are reading an awful lot into them. I also think it's really important to say that a book cannot change anybody's sexuality. I mean, if books could change our sexualities, we would all be straight. You know, we grew up reading about heterosexual families ad nauseum, and, you know, some of us are gay.
Leslea Newman is the author of Heather Has Two Mommies, Gloria Goes to Gay Pride, and Saturday is Patty Day. Michael Wilhoit is the author of Daddy's Roommate, and Uncle What Is It is coming to visit. This is Fresh Air. Today, Vice President Gore gave his plan for reinventing government. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that plan on All Things Considered?
Mara Liasson is at the White House, Terry, and she will be covering it. We'll hear from people around the country. I think it's safe to say a dose of skepticism about whether or not this plan will work. Elizabeth Arnold will join us for a lineup of the very full agenda that the Congress has this fall. Robert Siegel is in the Middle East, and he will be reporting on the split among Palestinians facing a peace agreement between Hamas and Fatah. And we'll be talking about going back to school, bad news from Chicago, New York City, and New Jersey, and summer reading.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In his 1984 novel, Neuromancer, William Gibson imagined a new computer universe, which he called cyberspace. Now there's a whole cyberpunk genre in fiction. Critic John Leonard has a review of Gibson's new novel, Virtual Light.
What happens in William Gibson's eagerly awaited new novel is that Rydell, a rent-a-cop, and Chevette, a bicycle messenger, and Yamazaki, an anthropologist, and Sublet, a refugee from a trailer camp video sect that finds the face of God in old movies on television, join forces with a bunch of computer hackers who call themselves the Republic of Desire, and they declare virtual war. This virtual war is declared on a Japanese gangster conglomerate called Sunflower and a Southern California law enforcement satellite called Death Star. I won't tell you who wins. The bad news is that Virtual Light is not as wonderful as Neuromancer, Gibson's first novel, in which, of course, he invented cyberspace, that realm of all data, that consensual hallucination, as he called it, into which his heroes could project their disembodied consciousness. He also invented SimStim, a world of holographic simulations that would later be called virtual reality, and Black Ice, the computer codes that protect an information matrix and punish intruders with brain death, and Wintermute, an artificial intelligence trying to steal a soul for itself, and Freeside, the orbiting brothel and banking nexus, a border town for human DNA spreading out from gravity's steep well like an oil slick. Virtual Light seems a bit thin after this prodigal inventiveness, not to mention subsequent cyberpunk fiction, from Bruce Sterling, Bruce Wagner, Mark Lehner, and even Neal Stephenson, whose Snow Crash 2 years ago also featured a Pony Express messenger heroine. The good news is that mediocre Gibson is interesting anyway. Virtual Light is really a chase movie script about a pair of stolen glasses. Through these glasses, what you see is what Gibson calls the data feed on what you're looking at. Whatever is known about the scene you see and can be digitized is downloaded from a matrix and fed by these glasses directly into your optic nerve. And this news, never mind why, is bad for San Francisco. The future, according to Gibson, is one big third world. The nicest people in it seem to live on the Oakland Bay Bridge, in the suspension, as it were, in a barrio shanty town of steel bones, stranded tendons, tattoo parlors, sushi bars, pawnbrokers, herbalists, and dropouts. Elsewhere, as in most cyberpunk fiction, the prospect is dreary, a post-apocalyptic moonscape of cartels and cults, stealth houses and downlinks, cryogenic vats and self-help euthanasia clinics, data havens in Costa Rica and Korean robot cleaning bugs, dream wells and Death Stars. Nor can you leave the hovel without a respirator, and you're better off carrying a fractal knife, because either the Sword of the Pig is waiting for you, or the South Island Liberation Front, the Wolfmen, or the Death Cookies. No wonder Rydell and Chevette hang out at a bar for cognitive dissidents and consult the god-eating rock dream chimeras of the Republic of Desire and end up starring in their own TV miniseries. Yamazaki, the anthropologist, clearly speaks for the author when he notes, "We are come not only past the millennium's turning, but to the end of something else. Everywhere the signs of closure. Modernity was ending." I don't know why cyberpunk novelists are always so gloomy and dystopic. I'm not sure I want to think about it instead of watching television. But for guys who like to play so much with their fancy goggles, all they seem to see in the virtual light is black ice and brain death.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Virtual Light by William Gibson. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Ron Barron, Chris Fraley, and Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Fabry is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Harry Belafonte on his life in music, movies, and the civil rights movement. This week he gives his first public concert in New York City in over 30 years. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
All right, banana.
Daylight come and we wander home.
Hide the deadly black tarantula.